call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order here, and today it is our great honor to have the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants in the room, who have done incredible analysis on the federal tax law changes both in 2008 and the recent federal stimulus package. And so our entire meeting today will be devoted to understanding those, hearing about those changes, understanding those changes with an eye toward, you know, deciding which, if any, of the changes we would like to reconnect to this session. So with that, I will ask Mr. Douglas and his contingent to introduce themselves and open, I guess I better open an informational meeting. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas. Joan Buck and I have had the pleasure of representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants for over 30 years, three decades.
Before you get going, did you want Joan to come up here as well? She hid. I didn't see her until just now.
We all know that Joan is the power in the building. During that 30 years, Madam Chair, we have consistently argued for what we call tax conformity, conforming Oregon's tax code as much as practicable to the federal tax code. We believe that helps taxpayers. We believe that helps tax practitioners. And we believe that also helps compliance. When the two codes are markedly different, we frankly believe that there's less tax compliance. We are not completely altruistic in this. It's also to our benefit as CPAs for the codes to conform because it narrows the number of potential malpractice traps that CPAs see in their practice. With that, I'd like to introduce the panel. We have Carrie Schoenfeld, Bob Karras, and Kim Spaulding, and they'll be going through the federal tax changes.
Thank you very much. If each of you, before you speak, could introduce yourself for the record, that would be great.
Madam Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Kim Spaulding, and I'm a practitioner in Portland, Oregon. What we've done is put together a booklet summarizing the federal legislative changes for 2008. And we've also put together a summary of the provisions in the recently enacted 2009 Act. What we'd like to do is spend some time first going through the 2008 provisions and highlight those items that we believe are of interest to the committee, and then spend some time highlighting the 2009 provisions as well. The booklet, you'll notice, is divided up into sections with tabs A and B and C, D, and E. We're going to spend the majority of our time of the 2008 booklet on the tab A, which are items that Oregon has already automatically connected to. Tab B covers items that don't impact Oregon because they are a credit or administrative provision that does not apply to Oregon. The few items that are in tab C do require a change for Oregon if they are to conform with the federal change. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bob, and he's going to start us off on the 2008 booklet.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Karras, and I'm a CPA in Clackamas, Oregon. I've been in practice for about 30 years. Kim and Carrie and I agreed to sort of proceed sort of thematically through this because much of this 2008 has already been incorporated into the Oregon law. So the first couple of things, though, are important. The first few things on page one of the Economic Stimulus Act. And the Economic Stimulus Act was the one that the federal government passed to kind of try and get the economy sort of revived back in February. In the early part of 2008, they were seeing that things were already starting to languish. So the first thing Act Section 102 talks about raising the Section 179 expensing limit to $250,000. And the next item, Section 103, gives taxpayers a 50% write-off on most of the fixed asset purchases they make during the year. This is important to the taxpayer. It saves lots and lots in taxes. And as a conformity issue, we're happy that the state of Oregon, at least for now, is conforming with these provisions in that it does enhance compliance as was stated earlier. The rest of the act on Section A really isn't that huge of a deal. There is an increase in passenger auto expensing that's allowed. On the next page, it begins with the Heartland Habitat Harvest and Horticulture Act of 08. And the idea here really is to enhance conservation efforts through tax initiatives. There aren't really any big tax things in this, and so in the interest of momentum and the interest of saving the committee precious time, we're just going to just basically say that about it and then just move on. We're not going to go into any of this in detail unless someone has a particular interest. These tend to not be huge tax items, huge items in the first place. And that takes us to, oh, Kim has an idea here. Oh, that takes us all the way to the HEROES Earnings and Assistance Relief Act of 08 on page 4, and Kim is going to take back over.
In June of 2008, the HEROES Act was enacted, and that provided relief for the military families. So on page 4 of the 2008 booklet, I'll just briefly describe the different provisions that were in that. Act Section 101 made it easier for the members of the service to receive their rebate checks. Paragraph 103, it relates to mortgage bonds issued to finance mortgages for veterans. And you'll note on the top of page 5, Oregon is one of the 5 states authorized to issue these types of bonds, and it increased the cap on how many of those could be issued. Act Section 104 provides additional protection of retirement benefits. Section 105 alters the treatment of differential military pay as wages, and that has to do with when employers agree to pay wages based on the earnings prior to when they were deported overseas. That's the wrong word.
Deployed. We don't deport them. We want them back.
Thank you. Deployed. Section 109 allows military death and life payments to be contributed to a Roth IRA or education savings account. Section 110 on page 6 is a suspension of the 5-year period for exclusion of gain on the sale of a principal residence by certain Peace Corps volunteers. Section 112 expands the amount of state payments to service members that are exempt from income. And Section 113 makes permanent an exclusion of gain on the sale of principal residence of certain employees of the intelligence community. Section 114 provides a special disposition rule for unused benefits in health flexible spending arrangements of individuals in active duty. Section 115 is a technical correction of the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act. Section 301 revises the tax rules of expatriation. So that brings us to the end of the HEROES Act. At the bottom of page 7, we have the Housing Assistance Tax Act, which was enacted in July. Sections 3007 through 3026 modifies and expands the requirements for bonds related to housing assistance. So that moves us down to the bottom of page 8. Sections 3031 and 3061 through 3061 modify the rules for real estate investment trusts, also called REITs. Down on middle of page 9, section 3081 provides corporations an election to accelerate AMT and research credit in lieu of bonus depreciation. Section 3082 allows Gulf Opportunity Zone homeowners the opportunity to amend a return claiming casualty losses. So that doesn't impact a lot of Oregon residents. Section 3092 provides that the gain from the sale of a principal residence allocated to non-qualified use is no longer allowed to be excluded from income. That one actually does impact probably Oregon residents. The Emergency Economic Stabilization Act was passed in October of 2008. And Section 301 allows community banks to treat losses as ordinary instead of capital losses. The community banks don't often generate capital gains, so those losses would have continued to go unused if that hadn't been changed. Section 302 limits the amount of deductible compensation for covered executives to $500,000. You may have heard that in the news. And that's only if the Treasury has purchased over $300 million of the subprime mortgage debt, mortgage securities. Section 303 extends the exclusion of mortgage debt forgiveness on a principal residence through 2012. And the Energy Improvement and Extension Act was enacted in October. And Section 109 through 308 all provide tax incentives related to energy conservation. I'm not going to go through the details of that act. And that brings me to the end of my section. I'll turn it back over to Bob on the middle of page 13.
On the middle of page 13, we're going to pick up with the Tax Extenders and Alt-Min Tax Relief Act of 08. And that was also part of this very large act, multi-section. It was sort of just a mishmash of different ideas at the time that they passed the Troubled Assets Relief legislation. So this part of that act is mainly an extension of tax breaks that were already in the tax law that were about to expire. You know, Congress said, "Well, we're going to not let those expire. We're going to keep those going." And it also fixes the alternative minimum tax. Alternative minimum tax isn't an Oregon issue, but we will be talking briefly about the things that do impact Oregon here. Since they're all continuations of existing tax law, we're going to breeze through them pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Above the line deduction for higher education expenses, above the line deduction for $250 of up to $250 for eligible educators for out of pocket expenses. Tax-free treatment of IRA distributions donated to charity. You can take money out of your IRA, donate it straight to charity, and don't have to worry about picking it up as taxable income and then claiming an itemized deduction for it. I'm going to skip down to the top of page 15. Act Section 305 talks about how we're renewing the federal legislature is renewing the 15-year cost recovery for qualified leasehold improvements and qualified restaurant improvements. There's an extension of the qualified leasehold improvement property, and then there's a new mandatory 15-year depreciation for qualified retail improvement property, which some of our clients will be interested in. Let's see, flipping over to page 16, mine safety equipment. Accelerated depreciation for business property on Indian reservations, special tax breaks for NASCAR racing tracks, expensing of environmental remediation, deductions for qualified computer contributions. You can see how this is all running, but these are all mainly extensions of existing tax law, and all we're doing, we're just saying, well, these were good before, and we still like them, so we're going to keep going with those. Over on page 19, Act Section 702 talks about temporary tax relief for areas damaged by the 2008 Midwestern severe storms, tornadoes, and flooding. What they're doing is basically they're taking the idea that they came up with after Hurricane Katrina, and they're saying, well, you know, Hurricane Katrina was a disaster for the Gulf area, but these tornadoes and the areas impacted by Hurricane Ike were also a disaster for these areas, and it's going to take a long time to dig their way out of those, so there's some tax benefits for people who have property in those areas. The reason why that's an Oregon of concern to Oregon is that there may be Oregon taxpayers, corporations, and individuals who have property in those jurisdictions that will be affected by these tax laws, that will be able to take advantage of these tax savings. And then we get back into more and more and more of the details here, and eventually wind up with on page 23 with Michelle's Law, where it's Carrie Schoenfeld's responsibility to move forward.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Schoenfeld, and I have a practice in the Portland area as well. I think Michelle's law is just very brief in that it's stating that an individual who is covered by health insurance but is in school and must take a leave from school for medical reasons can't be, the insurance can't be terminated, so it can continue on. So that's just a very brief one on that. Then moving on to the Worker, Retiree, and Employee Recovery Act, the majority of those provisions apply to defined benefit plans, and defined benefit plans are basically pension plans where an employer has to put all of the funds in and has guaranteed somebody the amount of a payment upon retirement. And so that's different from the newer 401k plans that most people are in, but a lot of those big corporations have defined benefit plans, and with the economy the way it is and the stock market falling, suddenly those are, most all of them have to be underfunded at this point. And so two-thirds of the provisions in this act really are giving more leeway to each of those corporations to fund over a period of years, because otherwise they would all be in default. And so these provisions, just we would automatically connect to them because a plan won't be disqualified if it has takes that extra leeway to fund those. So that's the majority of the provisions. And then I'll highlight a few of the other areas. One is that they have now allowed distributions from governmental plans to be rolled over into a Roth and a Roth IRA plan, which has not in the past. It was just non-governmental plans. In addition, individuals, they have allowed individuals, upon the death of an IRA holder, you can transfer it now to your children, and it can continue on into an IRA. They're now requiring for qualified retirement plans, so 401k plans and that type of plan, that the plan sponsor must allow a rollover into an IRA for a beneficiary at the death of the plan participant. So that's a broader rule. And I think the only other piece on that that I really wanted to point out was there is an exclusion for governmental plans. If a public safety officer takes a distribution, there can be up to $3,000 that can be taken out and applied to health insurance without being taxed. So those things all, again, will just automatically flow through with the December 31, 2008 reconnect. And the balance of the provisions in that section, again, just deal with the defined benefit plan and trying to make it a little more flexible to put the funds in over the next few years. After that, I turn to Section B. And again, the Section B is where these are mostly credits and do not impact Oregon at all. We don't feel that Oregon needs to make any change because these credits are things that won't impact our revenue. It's just a credit at the federal level. And just in very broad scope, the Heartland Habitat Act looked at just, again, as the prior, when we were going through the A's, it's just credits to encourage conservation and environmental issues. Over on the HEROES Earnings and Assistance Act on page 34, it's looking at more credits to servicemen and women to make it a little bit easier on them. There, this is also, though, I think a lot of us have heard about the parity of mental health benefits, and this is where this piece came in, that as of June 17, 2008, insurance plans have to give mental parity or insurance parity for mental health benefits together with other medical benefits. On page 36, the Housing Assistance Act, again, this is just a whole lot of different credits that help with the purchase of homes in different ways and for banks to be able to allow mortgages. Again, these are all federal credits that won't impact Oregon. So then moving on to page 39, the Energy Improvement and Extension Act. Again, just a lot of credits dealing with energy tax credits, fuel-efficient cars, and that type of thing. But again, it's just a credit off of your federal return and won't impact Oregon. Let's see, over on the tax extenders and alternative minimum tax, there, this is just, again, dealing with the alternative minimum tax, which is a federal tax, doesn't impact Oregon at all. The alternative minimum tax was extended for 2008, so a lot of the provisions in this section at page 45 through, really down through 54, deal with those issues. There is a refundable portion of the child tax credit. In the past, it couldn't be refundable, so it liberalized that, and again, just to make it a little bit easier for low-income taxpayers to get a refundable credit. I think one that piqued my interest was income averaging for amounts received on the Exxon Valdez litigation. So again, there's these very unique little credits in there, and income averaging is something that we don't allow, so it wouldn't impact us. The Inmate Tax Fraud Prevention Act, that's just allowing disclosure of IRS information with prisons, and that's a state issue there. But a lot of times the Department of Revenue is asking for that same leeway to be able to exchange information. And then finally, on page 55, the Worker, Retiree, and Employer Recovery Act, it's got increases the penalty for failure to file returns. And again, it looks at the defined benefit plan. This was something that was adopted when the defined benefit plans had a little bit more money. It was early in 2008 before they lost all of the money. And it was a provision saying that if there was excess funding, it could be taken out to help with retiree benefits. And at this point, I'm sure there's no excess fund, so it's somewhat irrelevant. So that's just a real quick overview of all of the credits, and then I'm going to turn it over to Bob.
All right, then. So now we're at the tab that's marked C/D, and we're looking at recommendation C. Again, to refresh your memory, recommendation C are not automatic reconnect items because they lie outside of the purview of automatic reconnect, but the society and the members of our group have identified a certain number of things that we believe the legislature might want to consider in terms of reconnecting with or staying connected with anyway in the interest of enhancing tax compliance. That's what I'm trying to say. So on page 56, the first thing that we thought we'd call your attention to is to make permanent the election to treat combat pay as earned income for purposes of the earned income credit. The earned income credit normally wouldn't be including combat pay because combat pay isn't part of a person's taxable income. But by treating combat pay as earned income for purposes of the EIC, then that enhances the earned income credit, and it allows the family of that military person to more readily qualify for the earned income credit. And the reason we thought it would be important for Oregon to conform to that is simply because Oregon already has an earned income credit, and we weren't certain whether or not, or at least I'm not certain, let me just say it that way, I'm not certain whether or not this definitional change is going to carry over into Oregon law. And if it didn't, you'd have a situation where a person would now have two different ways of having to calculate the earned income credit. One would have to be for your federal, and then you'd have to throw that all away and then do it again from the ground up on your state return. Right now, it's a very simple thing, and that's good, because people who qualify for the earned income credit don't want to pay me a lot of money to prepare their tax returns. So the earned income credit is a very simple calculation on your Form 40. It's simply 6% of the number that you had on your federal return. But if we don't stay connected here, then it's not that easy. And now it's like, oh, you start from the ground up, and you have different kinds of income that you can and cannot consider. And then we start going this way from the federal rule. So that's just something to think about. Another one, Act Section 106 of the HEROES Act. Again, the HEROES Assistance or Earnings Assistance and Relief Act was put in play to try and help people who were overseas serving our country, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan. This was an extension of statute of limitations to file claims for refund relating to disability determinations by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And basically what happens is this: if you're disabled and you've received a disability determination from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the federal tax law is now going to allow you a longer statute of limitations to go back and file an amended return or do whatever is necessary. It's going to extend that statute of limitations. That's important because somebody who's been overseas serving our country and who's become disabled as a result of that service may not have the capacity during this period allowed by the statute of limitations to be able to do those acts. And so in the committee, we thought that would be a nice thing. The statute of limitations has been enhanced for the federal return. A lot of times people don't realize, you know, if we don't make this change on Oregon law, things are going to slip between the cracks. The door is going to shut on those folks, and they're not going to be able to file a parallel amended claim on their Oregon return. The next one is a rather difficult one. It's an estate tax look-through rule for registered investment companies, in other words, mutual funds, owned by non-resident aliens. And that really has more of an impact on the estate tax. And I'm going to just skip it because I don't understand it.
Thank you.
It's one of those things I couldn't wrap my brain cells around it, so I thought, okay, well, I'm not going
to
talk about
it. We're going to ask Senator Telford to explain that one.
She's one of us, I hear.
Yeah, she is.
Okay, good. Then so on page 57, I didn't have any great way of just kind of skating by that one, so I just thought I would just, you know, make it obvious that I had no idea what it was about. Page 57, Act Section 702, talks about temporary tax relief for areas damaged by the 08 Midwestern severe storms. There's special rules for determining earned income, and that's, again, about the earned income credit. And, again, our mantra is always, you know, let's try and stay conformed, if we can, to the federal. If it makes any sense. And here again, the earned income credit is one of those things where we would prefer that people didn't actually pay a lot of accounting fees to prepare their tax returns if they're qualifying for the earned income credit. And then there's an adjustment regarding taxpayer independency status. Last but not least is another thing that that we've brought up in prior years in terms of asking the legislature to stay connected, and that's the clarification. That's in the uniform definition of a child. There's a statutory definition of who's a qualifying child in your household. That definition is outside the purview of automatic reconnect. By specifically adopting this statute, your Oregon tax return is going to count the same individuals as dependents as your federal return does. If we don't stay connected, you're going to have a different number of dependency deductions on your federal potentially than you do on your Oregon. So that's the recommendation C. There are no D's. And then the E's, I'm just going to say that recommendations E, as the tab indicates, are things that are outside the income tax law. They're parts of the income tax law, but a lot of times they're things like telling the Treasury to do a study of something or things of that nature. And these are all non-tax provisions, so we're just going to close the book on that part. And that is the end of my presentation, and that's the end of the presentation that's encompassed by our handy-dandy little guide here.
Okay, thank you. Just before we go on this section C, you said that it lies outside of the automatic reconnect, but Chris, do you want to tell us what the status of these provisions are in terms of our...
Sure, Senator. Chair, House Bill, part of what House Bill 2157 did was update various... provisions in law where we have to tie to definitions as of a specific date. So prior to 2157 becoming law, we were tied to definitions as of December 31st, 2007. Mm-hmm. When that bill became law, we became tied to definitions as of December 31st, 2008. So, for example, that piece of legislation was contained within that tie.
Okay, so even though this wasn't subject to automatic reconnect, it was included in 2157, so all of these items that are listed in tab C, D, we are now connected to, unless we change it. Thank you. Okay, well, are you ready for questions on this part of it, or did you want to move
now
on?
Might be a good time.
Okay, great. I'm going to open up for questions from the committee. If I see none right away, I'll start off with one on the, Senator Telfer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome. I'm just wondering if I'm getting CPE for this presentation.
No? I am. No, I'm just kidding.
Are we going to deal with the more current federal... Are you going to... Okay,
yes.
You are. Then actually, what I'm going to do then is hold my questions until after that presentation.
Actually, I would like an explanation going way back to page one on this expense deduction limit increase to $250,000. I'd like a little more detail. This is actually a very good summary, but a little more detail on how this expensing provision works, because this was also picked up in the federal stimulus of this year. And it's one of the ones that I wanted to look at in terms of encouraging small business to make investment. So I was wondering if you could go into a little more detail on how this works and how it phases out and what types of businesses are likely to benefit from that.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Since this is my piece of the presentation, I'd be happy to help that handle that for you. Ordinarily, when a taxpayer purchases a piece of what's called tangible personal property, which is something you can pick up and move around, that's eligible for depreciation over a life which might be as short as 5 years, might be as long as 10, 12, 15, something like that. And so when a person makes an, when a taxpayer makes an investment, and this is true for individuals who have sole proprietorships as well as corporations, any kind of a taxpayer. So when you've made, let's say you've made an investment of $100,000 in a piece of equipment, your taxes are going to go down by whatever your tax rate is times that $100,000. But it's not going to all happen in 1 year, right? It's going to take maybe 7 years to recoup that tax saving. So let's say the tax saving is 35%, $35,000 of tax savings spread over 7 years.
Right.
The advantage of the Section 179 expensing is that the tax law allows a taxpayer to collapse that stream of depreciation and those tax benefits all into a single year. So instead of waiting 7 years to collect that $35,000 in tax savings, we can spend $100,000 for the piece of equipment, get that $35,000 back in, and in the year of acquisition, be out of pocket the $65,000. So it's in a way it's a way for the federal government and Oregon as well, if Oregon stays conformed, of helping taxpayers in especially in capital intensive industries to make asset acquisitions. There's a limitation on that, and that is that in prior years, that limitation had been approximately $100,000. And if you were in a large enough industry where you were buying new pieces of equipment all the time and your capital expenditures went to $1 million or, even to $150,000, that you would hit that limit, and then you wouldn't be able to go beyond that limit. So that means that anything that you added above and beyond that would be subject to the ordinary rule of depreciation. Even though you'd like to get all of your tax savings in 1 year, you would be forced, for those assets that were above the $100,000 cap, you'd be forced to wait that 7 years to recoup that. So by raising the cap to $250,000, now all of a sudden more taxpayers are able to play and more taxpayers are able to get the kinds of tax benefits. Now, there is a phase-out on that, and you've pointed that out. And I might have forgotten to mention that, but that's important. And that is this, that I think that the law is, like a lot of federal law, is that it's intended to help people who need a hand and is not intended to help people who are doing fine, thank you very much. So if a corporation is big enough, and if a corporation has, $800,000 of fixed asset equipment, fixed asset additions for the year. And again, this is all tangible personal property. It's all desks and forklifts and things like that. If they have more than $800,000 of property acquisitions, they're a big enough company, they can take care of themselves. And eventually they wind up with the more fixed assets they buy during the year, within a given year, the lower of a limitation they've got until that limitation is zero.
So basically, anything up to $800,000, they can take the full $250,000 expenditure.
Exactly
expensing,
right.
And then it starts to phase out.
Then you're down to $200,000 to $250,000 and $100,000, and then to zero.
And what level does it phase out completely?
I'm unprepared to answer that particular question.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you. I just, deduction has come up, and it was never explained.
The rule has always been in place, but the cap on fixed asset additions was lower than $800,000 in the past. So when they went from 100 to 250, mm-hmm. they also went from, I think it was 400 to 800.
Okay.
So you know, I mean, in recognition that it makes some sense to do that.
Okay. Chair Burdick, I might also mention that if a company needs to have net profit in order to want to take this deduction. So in many ways, I think because of the economic downturn, we've got a lot of companies out there that they have no profit. They're not even going to consider taking this 179 deduction. So it's really only if you have a taxable income that you would take it. So yes, it's there, but how many people will even want to elect? Because you don't want to elect it and have that deduction in a year it won't benefit you. You'd rather defer it to those years where you would have gains. So,
and I assume that same principle applies to the bonus depreciation that in the down economy.
Right, you're not going to want to elect it.
The number that would,
mm-hmm. So I think it's hard to determine who would be using it, but it's only going to be those smaller profitable businesses mm-hmm. that have the ability.
That's an excellent point.
Thank you for clarifying that. Senator Telford.
Another question for Bob, but before we move on, I want to just mention that the bonus depreciation doesn't have the floor limits on net income. So a little different reasoning why somebody would defer it or not defer it. So, but the question I have is, if somebody had $100,000 of capital purchase and took 179 and got $35,000 of cash back in, let's say federal and 10th state, they've got $45,000 back in their pocket. What do they have to do with that money? Buy more capital assets or increase payroll and, you know, I mean, that's its purpose.
That's a good question.
Is that correct?
That's a good question, and I've never really thought about what the intention is that a taxpayer, or what the expectation is that the federal government had for what the taxpayer would do with the tax savings. I think the way I have always looked at it was that it's a good thing to make sure that the machine tool industry is a healthy one here in the United States, the machine tool industry being the people who make equipment that they sell that gets sold to other businesses, things like forklifts. The backbone of the manufacturing economy, I think, in my humble opinion, is in large part in the machine tool industry. These kinds of provisions keep the machine tool industry going, keep that industry healthy. What is a taxpayer likely to do with the money? They could go to Bermuda. I think that would be fun.
If I might, I think generally, and for my clients, it's a cash flow issue, and so if they know they're going to get a portion back in taxes, then they're more likely to spend that money in the first place. If they can only make payroll and they don't have enough to buy that new piece of that new forklift, then they're not going to buy it. But if they know that they're going to be able to get a credit on their taxes, then they're not having to pay as much in. So I think it's a total cash flow issue if they, in fact, need that piece of equipment.
Okay. So I gather from your comments that you, in this economy, that you all don't think that this is a particularly valuable provision for small business at the federal level in this economy. Is that correct?
I think that we'd have to say that, you know, as it comes back and we start to see profit and companies have the funds and maybe have had a couple of years where they haven't been spending, I can see that in maybe 2011, when we hope to be coming out of this, that it could be very beneficial to those that haven't been able to spend, because I think right now what we're seeing is clients making payroll and doing the things they have to do. Mm-hmm. Now, there may be some pieces of equipment that they just have to buy, but again, do they have a net profit that they'd want to take that deduction? So, and I do have my tax code with me to answer your question and complete, if you'd like an answer before we leave.
Okay, thank you. And the other question I had on this whole report was more global, and that is, am I missing something, or are all of these provisions that you summarized, are these all revenue losers? Are there any provisions in here, changes in the tax code, that actually tighten up things or end up producing more revenue?
I can't think of this.
Yeah, I don't know that we analyzed it with that in mind.
But I can't think that there are. I don't think we came across any that did. I mean, just in going through them, most of them were trying to, I mean, for example, the pension benefits probably don't have any impact on tax whatsoever, other than it keeps the plan qualified. I think that's where we saw a lot of provisions just trying to keep things qualified in encouraging people at a federal level to purchase houses and that type of thing. But I don't know that we did come across anything that I can write off think would have raised. Chris, are you thinking?
A comment that in its title alone, Economic Stimulus Act, I would imagine that what they're trying to do is stimulate economic activity instead of inhibit it with increased in taxes. And if I'm hearing the panel correctly, what I'm seeing is businesses not making a lot of money right now, and the more we can do to stimulate them with some tax dollars back in their pocket through incentives is what's going to actually stimulate them.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Chair Burdick, I did think of one thing that was actually a revenue raiser, and it was in the required percentage of estimated taxes that certain corporations would have to pay in about 5 years. It was a silly piece of legislation. It only applied to corporations who had over $1 billion in assets, and for those corporations that their fourth quarter estimated payment, the one that was going to be due in the fall, was going to have to go to 117% of normal I think if the wind was blowing west from southwest, it was truly, and the reason was that without that, they couldn't have gotten the thing to be revenue neutral. And so particular act, and this is something that, this is a very good question. There must be in here, there must be revenue raisers, because they are under the gun federally to balance the revenue impact of
not
these things.
Longer.
Not any longer. Well,
not on the stimulus.
Well, that shows you what I know. There you go.
But they did. But that's actually a good comment. They did portray this 2008 stimulus as being revenue neutral.
I don't know that 2008 stimulus. I think up until that point they had tried to. So, but I think on the stimulus they gave up at that point.
Because there are several different enactment dates here, and I don't know if this all qualifies as a stimulus.
No. So these began early in 2008. So we're just reviewing those through 2008 because you all had connected to those specific provisions at the end of 2007. But there were numerous tax acts, I think eight throughout the year, quite a few.
They weren't all marketed as stimulus.
No. This was where one was more for the servicemen and women to try to, so those types of things. They were all very unique.
Okay. Senator Hass and then Senator Telfer.
Well, on the same thought, I was trying to look through these and see whether the objective was to change behavior or put more money in people's pockets. And I couldn't, some of them are, for example, the increased depreciation for passenger automobiles. That was the motive there, to help the auto industry so it's easier to justify buying new cars, or is it just to save some money to stimulate the economy that way? I just couldn't.
Well, Senator Haas, I believe you're that when we've seen this kind of legislation in the past, you have it correct that the whole idea would be to stimulate, in fact, a particular industry, and that would be the automotive industry with this tentacle effect throughout the economy. There's lots of feeder industries that rely on a healthy automotive industry. But nevertheless, I think that this particular one is not only designed to stimulate the economy as a whole, but also to specifically give a little boost to the auto industry, because we saw that when they did the special write-offs for the large SUVs about 5 or 6 years ago. That was something where clearly that was targeted to the automotive industry, and they're doing that again here. Absolutely, that's my opinion, but I believe that to be true.
That was our least favorite tax credit.
Well, that's my point. I mean, it's just, the pendulum swings back. I mean, the passenger, forget about SUVs for a second, this used to be criticized as well because, doctors and lawyers were writing off these sports cars and that, in effect, subsidizing their cars with a wink and a nod. And there was efforts to try and eliminate this very sort of thing that we're now expanding. And I guess that's just a comment here.
Well, Senator, they could also buy a Prius.
True.
Temporarily.
Doesn't say that, though, in this.
Temporarily.
Doesn't say Prius or Jaguar.
Oh, no, you're right, it doesn't.
Yeah, but it limits it.
Senator,
so you're not going to, you're going to take a lot of years to write off a Jag. That's the whole point here, it's quite a limit on that first year of depreciation.
Did you have a question, Senator Telfer?
No, it was a comment, recognizing the question about the Stimulus Act. Yes, there are a number of acts here, and so not all of them are stimulus. But you were commenting on, was it revenue neutral?
Mm.
And probably not, but unlike us, the federal government has an opportunity to just make money. They've reduced revenue, tax revenue, in order to stimulate the economy, and if they can't cut their budget, they just make more money. So we don't have that ability here, unfortunately.
We're envious at
times. I kind of floated that idea of having Oregon money that you can just kind of use in Oregon. I mean,
pictures of the Oregon dollars.
Sure, why not?
Okay. Any other questions from the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I do have some Kulongoski bucks somewhere in my pile for the earned income tax credit if you want to borrow some of those. But my question actually is about the Pension Protection Act modifications. And is there a separate piece of federal legislation that was similar to that required adequate funding of present and future medical benefit liability. I thought there was a big piece of federal legislation, the acronym of which I can't remember, that dealt with.
We haven't seen anything, and I don't really recall that there was any legislation. I suppose if it didn't affect taxes, we wouldn't have picked it up. But I don't recall seeing, even hearing
that
something.
That may have lying wholly without outside the area of taxation.
Now, and where there were some provisions, there was allowing funding from the large defined benefit plans to go over to help fund that.
Right,
that was the
that.
Limit to what. I think I've seen on anything. And there was a little bit that got picked up again in this 2009 Stimulus Act that dealt with the same issue, but not payments into those. And I think from a taxability standpoint, it's not really a deduction anyway until they're paid out, so it might not impact the tax, and it could still be out there. So.
Speaking of the 2009 Stimulus Act, I think we'll move on to that now, and then we'll open questions for that. And if any other questions want to be asked at that time on this one, we can. But I just want to make sure we don't run out of time before we talk about this one. So let's start with the 2009, I guess it's called HR1.
Yes, earlier this month, we all know this was enacted, and surprisingly, there were very few number of items that impact Oregon's economy, but what we've done is summarized in this table that I hope you all have in front of you the various provisions that were included in this, tax provisions, that is. I'm not going to talk about each one of these because a lot of them, like I said, don't impact Oregon. The first page contains credits that Oregon doesn't have. On the middle of the second page, the earned income credit, like we talked about earlier today, it was increased, and so at this point we have a disconnect from the earned income credit, and as Bob was describing, we would need to do a separate calculation for that. Lots of credits. We'll just keep looking through. You can skim through the various credits that were a part of this act. Again, that don't have any Oregon impact. Going all the way to the bottom of page 5, there was a change to the alternative minimum tax. Oregon doesn't have AMT, so it doesn't impact Oregon. The first real item of interest, I think, is on the top of page 6, and that is the unemployment compensation. There's a new law that allows taxpayers to exclude $2,400 of unemployment compensation from their income. That's obviously an item that you're interested in and have not connected to at this point. The next one is a discharge of indebtedness. Instead of recognizing all of that income in year one, in the year that the debt's renegotiated, it's allowed to be included in income ratably over 5 years. So that's a timing difference for taxpayers.
And that does affect Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as does the unemployment compensation. Yeah, it will definitely have an income impact. The next item, on all these items on the page 6, I don't think have a big impact or any impact at all. But going to the top of page 7, we get into the depreciation topics, and that's, we've touched on that today. Bonus depreciation is a little different than 179 in that it allows taxpayers to deduct 50% of the cost of the assets they've purchased during the year in the current year rather than deducting them over the depreciable life of the asset. That bonus depreciation was extended for 2009, and we are currently not connected to this rule. So that's another timing difference, which means that the budget impact or the impact on Oregon's budget in the current year from disconnecting will be reversed in later years as the assets depreciated. If Oregon stays disconnected from this provision, that is going to require taxpayers to keep separate depreciation records for the future, all future years in which that asset is held. So keeping those depreciation records is very difficult because taxpayers buy many assets and sell many assets every year. And also taxpayers are reporting to many states, all of which sometimes have different rules. So they're keeping multiple records for multiple states. One of the biggest problems we see is that taxpayers change accountants, and in future years when they have these different state depreciation records, those records can get lost. And so those are what we find is that it's difficult to comply and with the difference in depreciation between federal and state.
Could I ask a question?
Senator Telfer.
A little clarification.
Yeah.
So when somebody switches CPA, so to speak, there's not a depreciation schedule attached to the tax return. It's additional supplemental information that may or may not be provided to the tax preparer. They may or may not have it. So that's some of the nightmare you're talking about.
That is correct, because typically the accountant or CPA maintains those depreciation records, and often they aren't provided to the taxpayer.
Well, and that just goes question. To show you should never switch accountants. Go on.
Yeah. I wanted to point out
more. Sometimes we leave and go to Salem, and so we have to.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the one that was so problematic with respect to revenue.
Correct.
To our state. And my question would be, how important is this from a business perspective to actually stimulate purchases?
Well, I can just, I've got a client that is going to rely significantly on I guess, actually, we're kind of looking at the net operating loss. I'm thinking of some of that part. But I think on the depreciation piece, for the depreciation, it's going to be the same issue I said before. Those that are in a loss position, I don't know how much it's going to affect them or impact their decision to buy property. Now, the net operating loss and the carryback, I think we're going to have significant. That can really help those that are really in dire straits. But I think this is that same depreciation issue of will they want the extra depreciation or will it not assist them now? Is if they're in a loss situation, I think we were all discussing fourth quarter of 2008 is when we're seeing things really turned around for all of our clients. And so some may still have profits, but really even viable businesses don't necessarily have a profit right now. They're in a loss situation and they may be buying equipment but wouldn't want the extra depreciation.
However, it is possible with the new net operating loss carryback rules that they could realize an economic tax savings from the bonus depreciation, whereas they are prohibited from doing that with Section 179. So it's very difficult for us to tell and determine what the impact is. I think taxpayers are expecting a big benefit from the bonus depreciation. I think it's a big item.
Was a big item.
It's a big item for federal. And on the 2008 tax returns that we're currently preparing, it's a big item.
Well, yeah, but you said they're expecting a big benefit from bonus depreciation, and yet on the other hand, you're indicating that it may not be... how do those...
For 09, how do those...
Are you talking about the difference between 179 and bonus depreciation?
No. I'm talking about... I thought I heard you say that the taxpayers were expecting a big benefit from bonus depreciation for 2009.
Taxpayers that have a profit would get a benefit on their 2009 tax return. Taxpayers that have losses would have the opportunity to carry back the losses to earlier years in which they did have a profit, and in that respect they could get a refund.
Okay, and that's under the next provision.
Mm-hmm. Well, they kind of tie together, and so what I was saying is that the bonus depreciation may create a loss, which would allow them to carry the loss back to a previous year.
Okay, but the net operating losses provision that's next on here is also new with the federal stimulus package, right?
The time period during which you carry it back is new. You could still carry it back. It would just be for a different time period if you don't connect with the new federal law.
Okay. Well, are there other questions on bonus depreciation? Because why don't we move to the... go ahead.
This is a more general question, but it does relate to this. So I assume presentations like this are being made in the other 49 states across the country by their state organizations. But is there a national umbrella organization, you mentioned corporations, that would be filing taxes in a number of states, and Oregon's not the only state, obviously, that's faced with some policy choices relating to tax changes. So is there a national organization of which you're affiliated that tracks state by state what these changes are? No.
Well, there's a couple.
Senator Rosenbaum, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants may do something like this at the state level, but I'm not familiar with it if they do, and none of us here are familiar with it. Technical publications that we subscribe to will have that information, but those are just editorial in nature. They don't come and testify on behalf of clients. They're not, or on behalf of the industry as a whole. So does that answer your question? I mean, in other words, if you asked me that question as a client, and you said, well, what are the other states doing on Section 179? I could easily look up the answer to that question, yes.
I guess a follow-up. I was just thinking, if you had a client who was operating in more than one state, unless they are supposed to have separate accountants in every state, obviously you'd have to be able to advise them what the tax laws were in all those other states, right?
That's correct, and that gets back to what Kim was talking about, where, okay, here we have our depreciation schedule for the federal return, for the federal return, and now I'm going to go to the Oregon return, and I have a different depreciation schedule. Same taxpayer, same assets, and now I'm going to be working on my California return, because the basis for reporting income is derived with respect to the same assets, even though the asset may be located here in Oregon, but the taxpayer has nexus in the state of California, is required to file a California return, and we have to maintain a different depreciation schedule than the Oregon one for California. How many more states are there that have different rules? Some are swallowing conformity, some are going along with conformity, some, like California, sorry to tell you this, are just saying, no, we just, you know, we're the one of the world's largest economies. If you want to play here, you know, that's the price of doing business. So they've elected not to follow the increase to the Section 179. They're in a different situation in the state of California. And they certainly are today. I don't know what's a different situation.
Madam Chair, maybe I think as a CPA, there is no umbrella. We have to learn all those different states' tax laws, as well as the state we're operating in and the federal. So it is very burdensome when these kinds of things happen, that we have to be proficient in all those different states. So if that's the question you were asking, how do we know?
And I'd like to point out that in 1996, the state offered a one-time depreciation catch-up, and that allowed a resolution of this very issue, in that from 1981 to 1985, there were differences and there was a disconnect in depreciation. Those differences carried on for the next decade because these assets are depreciated over such long lives, that there were taxpayers that still had to compare their state depreciation schedule or schedules, if they're in multiple states, to federal, and make a corresponding subtraction on their state returns for those differences. Well, you know, you can see that gets to be cumbersome, and at that point it was a decade ago, and so there was a one-time catch-up. There was also a catch-up that was included in that related to Section 179, that the legislature had gone ahead and conformed with the federal Section 179, but it wasn't until 2 years after taxpayers had filed their tax return. So for those taxpayers that went ahead and filed amended returns, they were covered, but those that opted to not amend their tax returns, because that's expensive and sometimes not always worth it, they included those items in the one-time catch-up as well.
Oh, that's interesting. That was coming out of a recession at that time, so that might be something that we might want to look at this time.
And I would say that to this right now, most states are connected. I mean, and we're not seeing a lot of divergence. Now, it may start, but right now we're not having 50 different depreciation schedules that we have to maintain. I think to this point, the states have stayed fairly connected. So, but we may see that change.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Next item, net operating losses.
Net operating losses. Corporations are not allowed to carry back their net operating loss, so this provision impacts individuals. The description says allow small business taxpayers, but what that means is the pass-through entities, the S-corporations and the partnerships, for which their revenue doesn't exceed $15 million in 2008, those taxpayers are going to be allowed to carry their losses back for 5 years instead of 2 years.
It says irrevocable. So they pick their number of how many years they want to carry back, and then they can't change that later.
Correct.
Okay. After that year.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Our understanding and interpretation from reading the Oregon statutes is that you've automatically connected to this provision based on the wording in the statute. So even though you disconnected from most of the other provisions in 2009, we believe you are automatically connected to this.
How would that be? Because it doesn't change it from 2008?
The reason is The reason is the wording in the statute, and I brought that with me. I can find it. It is, the wording is, as it applies to the tax year for which the tax return is filed. So it falls outside some of those items of taxable income that we're dealing with on the other provisions.
Okay. All right. Chris gave the nod, too. So we're connected to that in 2157. Okay.
Right. Yeah. All right. For individuals.
And so, okay.
So the next item is the Section 179, which we've touched on. It falls under the same realm as the bonus depreciation that we just discussed.
Now, it says it's indexed for inflation. So far, we're not in a state of deflation, but if that should happen, I mean, everything else has, why not, then that would go down. Would it go down, or is there a protection against it going down?
Well, it's set to expire after 2009,
mm-hmm.
and these amounts have already been determined for 2009.
Okay. Oh, so. I see. So if it were to be continued, then it would be indexed. Okay.
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
Thank you.
Going down to the limitation on net operating loss at the bottom of that page, Section 382, Bob's going to take you through that provision.
The rest of really where we're going to pick up now is just at the bottom of page 7 there. It's talking about limitation on net operating loss. And there's actually two things here. There's 382M and then 382N, and they really kind of deal with the same thing. When the Congress realized that banks needed to be bailed out with the Troubled Assets Relief Program, the U.S. Treasury...
We're on the top of page 8.
Right, okay. Exactly. At the bottom of 7 and the top of 8. Right. The U.S. Treasury forced some shotgun marriages between banks. And many times what would happen would be that a smaller bank that had been running at a loss, that was in financial difficulty, that had what's called a net operating loss in its portfolio of tax attributes, would be acquired by a larger bank. The way the rules work is this: if big company A swallows up little company B, the net operating losses of little company B aren't usable to the big company. They're only usable against the income that's being generated by the assets that were acquired from that little company. So the whole idea there was that the Congress, in the years when they wrote this rule, which was about 20 years ago, they didn't want to help, they didn't want to foster swallowing, you know, the big companies swallowing up little companies just to gobble up net operating losses. Well, it's a great tax planning strategy, right? I've got this big company, a big profitable company. I don't want to pay so much in income taxes. Why don't I buy one of my competitors that's been losing money all these years, probably because of competitive disadvantage because I'm big and they're little. I'll buy them, I'll get their net operating loss, and I'll use it against my tax dollars going forward. Can't do that. So the Treasury saw that part of the Treasury was arranging these forced marriages between these banks, and the Treasury wrote this IRS notice 2008-2383, and they said, you know what, we think that it's within our regulatory authority to tell you to forget about that whole rule, and that you, big bank, can use the net operating losses from the little bank that you just swallowed up. And the Congress said, No, we don't think you have that authority. We want that authority for ourselves. So they told the Treasury the notice was no good, and then they wrote their own rule the way they wanted it. And there's certain ifs, ands, and buts that allow them to do it their way, but my point is that the rule basically still the case. So in the situation where we have here in Oregon, where J.P. Chase Morgan, a big, maybe profitable, who knows, bank, swallows up Washington Mutual, now J.P. Morgan Chase can utilize those net operating losses to reduce its own taxable income. That's important to us as to the state of Oregon, because there's nexus. J.P. Morgan Chase, by acquiring those assets here in the state of Oregon, now is going to be filing Oregon income tax returns. This rule allows them to lower their income tax burden by utilizing those net operating losses against the income that the whole group is earning. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Okay, so basically, because we're not connected, they can get a relief from some of their federal taxes, but not state taxes.
As the way it reads right now, yes, I would say.
Because we're not connected.
Because we're not connected at this moment, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. How does this apply to the community banks? We've already had two bank failures. Does this disconnect adversely affect Citizens Valley Bank takeover of the Silverton Bank?
Unfortunately, I'm not familiar enough with the details of those acquisitions, and I'm not familiar enough with the details of these rules, but let's quickly read here. It says that this provision applies where there will be certain ownership changes pursuant to restructuring plans required under loan agreements or lines of credit entered into with Treasury under the Troubled Assets Restructuring Program. So if this marriage that we're talking about between Citizens Bank and whoever it was that wound up acquiring it,
Silverton,
mm-hmm. if that was something that the Treasury said you've got to do, and if a certain amount of if there was loan agreements that were being guaranteed or lines of credit that were being offered to the acquiring bank as a result of this transaction, or to facilitate this transaction, to make the transaction like survive, because I mean, let's face it, one bank really can't take on some of these liabilities without getting some kind of help from the Treasury. If they fall into this, then that may indeed be a situation that we're talking about, where the losses of the smaller bank would not be able to be utilized by the larger banking institution, by the acquiring banking institution under Oregon law.
It will be very specific, I think, as to which banks can use it. And a lot of the banks are buying up not the loans and just the taking over the deposits, so you don't have a net operating loss, so it's not actually a merger. So we just don't know.
I think the question is not so much whether they can use the federal credit, but if they can the federal benefit, but if they use the federal benefit, then
they would be limited.
Then they cannot use the state one because we're not connected.
Whether it just wouldn't be available at the state level, yes.
So they'd have to go back.
If it's available at the federal level at all.
Yeah, so they'd have to go back to the strictest limitation where they can't use the losses
right.
of the...
Is that what
you were trying to get at?
Well, yeah, I guess you have a federal charter and you have the state chartered banks. We're dealing with state chartered banks. And when you have a failure of a state chartered bank and another state chartered bank assumes that, those assets and liabilities... I guess if they don't take the stock of that corporation,
then it's a non-event. Right.
It's a non-event.
Okay. And if it's, and I think the state-to-state probably wouldn't fall within this definition for federal anyway because it's not required by the Treasury. So that's where I think, as Bob says, it's real specific as to the terms. But it's like, I mean, in terms of the chance that it wouldn't impact it, but we just don't know.
Yeah.
Like, have you...
I understand that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Then you can tell me later.
Okay.
I thought I understood until... Okay.
All right. So may I proceed then, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
The next items are not quite so huge, but as this, or potentially huge as this. I mean, I don't know what impact this is going to really have here, especially in the state of Oregon. But qualified code section 529 has been affected by the 2009 Act, qualified tuition programs. Code section 529 plans are the type of plans where a person would put away money for a savings plan for a dependent's educational expenses, future educational expenses. And in the past, money taken out for certain things would not result in tax-free withdrawals from that Section 529 plan. If you wanted to pay for a car, let's say for the college student, that would not be a qualifying distribution from the plan, and then and taxable income would be the result of that withdrawal. What they've done here in the 2009 Act is that they've broadened the list of transactions that it's okay to pull money out to cover, and those things are computer hardware, computer software, and internet access. So now, if the student is now going to college and says, geez, you know, I need to have a computer, then mom and dad don't have to wring their hands and fret that they're going to take out money out of the 529 plan and have it be taxable, or find some other asset resource to pay for that computer equipment. And I think there's probably a stimulus concept here in that the technological industry would benefit from it, and I think the Congress believed that the economy as a whole would benefit from it. I'm going to skip down to Act Section 1202. There's a small impact here. I'm sorry, Code Section 1202. It talks about partial exclusion for gain for certain small business stock. It's a provision that's in the tax law. It's a provision that I don't see utilized very frequently. There's no automatic reconnect at this point to that exclusion. Let's see, on page 9, they're really either the items on page 9 are either not applicable to the state of Oregon because they deal with credits or withholding provisions or other administrative provisions, or they deal with relatively minor things like the credit for qualified bonds allowed to the issuer and trading tribal governments as states for the purposes of issuing qualified bonds. And now that's the end of my presentation on this act, and I'm turning it over to Carrie.
So I'm on the very last page, and just to kind of give you an overview, and we thought it was something that we're all interested in, and it will flow through, I think, some of the revenue impact. But this is the health insurance issue as far as federal government sort of stepping in and trying to help extend COBRA benefits. So I think you've seen a lot on the news about it. When somebody is losing their job, they're entitled to COBRA benefits for a period of usually 18 months, and they can elect to pay their continuing health insurance coverage, but it's usually so expensive for that individual to pay that they let it lapse. And so this provision says that the individual only needs to pay 35% of it, and the employer has to pay the balance of it, and the employer then gets an offset from federal government against that 65% that they are paying. And it's only for up to 12 months. I think this came in, sort of starts applying mid, I think it's if somebody's lost their job after September 1, 2008 through the end of 2009. So there are individuals out there who would have lost their job, did not elect COBRA benefits, but now would perhaps like to get COBRA benefits. A notice should be coming out in the next couple of weeks from the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation as to what has to be given to those individuals as to their elections and their options. The way that an employer then will receive that kind of recoup their payment is against federal withholdings, and for both FICA taxes and just federal withholding taxes, it will actually be taken as a deduction when they submit their return to the IRS, whether it's monthly, quarterly, or each pay period. And the IRS is to arrange something so that there can be a credit for those that actually should receive a credit. So there's a lot of work for the government to do on figuring out exactly how this is going to work, but that's sort of the gist of it.
These are credits for the employer for their 65%?
Yes, so basically it will be offset against that. So
by offset, do you mean a
credit? Well, so really they would have, I suppose I'm envisioning an expense on their return, but then a deduction, so that those two things, they really will, it'll be a net zero, that they shouldn't be paying anything. This is the way the federal government is funding this. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't affect, and that shouldn't flow through and impact Oregon. There is also a provision saying that to the extent the employer is paying that 65%, it will not be taxable to the individual. So, okay. So that's just a general overview on the COBRA piece.
Okay.
And I think that's the 2009 Act.
Okay, wow.
Very brief. Question.
Senator Morris.
If I'm hearing correctly, then our disconnect from this provision is really a disadvantage for unemployed workers.
No, because this is required at a federal level. So I would say this probably, it just means that I suppose they could be taxed on that 65%. if an Oregon resident could potentially be taxed on the 65% because it's a benefit the employer's paying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not set up at the federal level so that it would be a non-taxable benefit, so I think it would be a taxable fringe benefit. And I think that's how it would hurt our... So I would think this is certainly something we'd want to connect, and it shouldn't impact us dollar-wise, but would make sure, I suppose, unless we want to tax those individuals on it. But we probably don't.
But what you're saying is that there's a provision in here that the feds don't tax, the feds, on your federal taxes, you won't be taxed for the 65%?
Correct, because otherwise it is a fringe benefit, and the IRS, and so therefore we too, tax fringe benefits unless they are specifically excluded. Well, Congress didn't need to put a specific exclusion in for this because or I guess they did exclude it for that piece. And we would not pick up that exclusion from a taxable fringe benefit.
Okay, so basically they would not be taxed at the federal level for that 65% benefit, but they would be taxed at the state level because we're not connected.
I think they would, and we haven't looked specific, but I don't think there's any exclusion that would prevent it, so they would be taxed.
I think it's also possible there will be a revenue impact in 2009 related to the employer costs that they have to pay up front for these, and then they don't get a reimbursement for that cost until they file their payroll tax return. So I would imagine there are going to be employers paying these in the fall of 2009 and not getting a credit until 2010. So there could be a slight impact spanning those 2 years, but it's timing.
And that's only if their credit back would exceed all payroll taxes to go in, because it's actually going to be reported, oddly, on their payroll tax.
Right.
Form. So that's only going to hit some employers that didn't have enough withholding. Hopefully they have enough of a workforce that they're withholding other taxes that would offset it. So there could be some, but what it would be, and presumably minor.
Can you imagine somebody trying to file their taxes these days without a CPA?
Or without software?
I don't mean to sound like an advertiser.
Even with CPA.
Yeah. Wait,
that's
struggle.
Right. I think the Treasury Secretary did try to do that.
Let's talk about that off the record, because I have a very strong opinion about that.
Lesson learned. Okay, other questions from the committee? All right. Thank you. This has been incredibly valuable to us. Thank you so much for doing all this work on this. And your chart is, both your booklet and your chart are very clear and focused, and I really appreciate you coming. We also, I think some members of the committee might have, certainly I do, have some more global questions as long as we have you here before us. And that is, you all are closest to the ground of an economy that most of us have not seen in our lifetime, frankly. And so I'm just wondering what trends you're seeing among particularly your high-end clients that might have an impact on what kind of revenue situation we're going to see going forward, specifically for this biennium, but it also going into the next biennium. I mean, we've heard anecdotal reports of reductions in quarterly payments. Some companies have stopped making quarterly payments. And would like to get your perspective. You're all experienced CPAs on what you're seeing differently now than you've seen in the past and what you think it means, especially for state revenue.
Well, I've definitely seen almost all of my clients impacted. That's going to impact the revenue for Oregon. They're laying off employees. They're not receiving payments from their customers. So that's revenue on both sides. It's revenue that our clients, the businesses, are not getting. It's revenue the individuals are not earning. So, those are definite impacts. And they're making cuts whenever they can and turn into cash flow issues like we talked about earlier. So it's pretty widespread.
And is it safe to say this is the worst you've seen since? How long have you been doing this?
15 years.
15
yes,
years.
Yes, it's definitely the worst that I've seen.
Okay, thank you.
I think some of the other things that I'm seeing are just, again, lots of layoffs, looking at loan problems, and especially with the bank failures, I'm afraid we haven't even begun to see what's going to hurt our economy as the bank failures hit and their loans are frozen, can't pay payroll, can't exist. So I think that'll really start to hit us. I'm seeing clients that can't pay their taxes for the prior year and are looking forward to those net operating losses to help them to go back and to essentially pay those taxes with the net operating losses, and that's how they feel they're going to survive. In working with the Department of Revenue as well as the IRS on putting those payments off and putting them on some type of a payment plan and hoping to get this year's taxes done quickly enough to help offset. So I think those net operating losses, in my experience, are part of what may save some of the businesses that are really pretty viable, but they've got some real problems in cash flow right now. And if we start to see bank failures, we're going to have real problems with the cash flow.
Now, what do you mean, what kind of bank failures?
Well, I think what we're seeing for some is on the bank failures now, that if the FDIC comes in and a bank takes over and takes only the deposits, I think, in my estimation, this is part of why we're hearing about the nationalization of banks. They're not taking the loans. And on some of the banks, one of them in my area, they did not take any of the loans, and so all of those are frozen in time. Even a construction loan that it was just fine and in good shape, suddenly the bank's not lending on it anymore and it goes into the FDIC and is frozen. So all of those employees are laid off because there's no longer a job until it takes quite a bit of time to try to work out. And at this point, it'd be hard to get another bank to step in and take over those loans. I think that's where a healthy operating company that needs that operating line of credit or uses it for inventory suddenly has it frozen and can't be borrowing. And so, they pay it off, but they can't continue to borrow to operate their businesses. So I think that's where there's cash flow issues are tough right now, but I'm very nervous that it can get very tough if we see more bank failures.
And how long have you been doing this CPA thing?
I guess I've been practicing for over 20 years.
20 years. So that puts you in 89, probably, when you started.
Well, so 25 years.
25 years.
Okay,
so
I'm older than that.
You were coming out just at the end of the last, probably the worst one before
right
now. And is it true for you that you've not seen anything like this before?
Mm-hmm. I think to this magnitude. And I suppose we've seen some of it to this point, but maybe we're projecting out what we're going to see the rest of the year. So maybe to this point we've seen some of it, but I think we're looking at a longer period than maybe we've seen in the past.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'd like to throw in my two bits worth, because you asked a question, and I think that I have something to offer about that. I've been in public accounting since the late 1970s, and in the late 1970s, you may recall, interest rates went like to 18% on certain types of borrowing, and people were still in the construction industry, still had projects that weren't complete yet, and had to continue borrowing in order to complete those projects, and they were on a variable interest rate, and they were all of a sudden looking at 18. And I remember one of my clients in those days actually was up to 21% interest rate. He was unable to complete the project. He was unable to sell it because the economy or the market for the assets that he had constructed had collapsed. He was building condominiums, and the bank wound up owning those condominiums. Here's my point. There's a difference. In the late 1970s, early 1980s, the interest rates were astronomical. The construction industry suffered tremendously, but the banks themselves were fine. We have a really different situation here, that the banks are in trouble. And when the banks are in trouble, it starts looking a lot more like the early 1930s. And I'm not trying to be I'm not a Jeremiah, but because I'm really not. But nevertheless, mistakes were made in the 1930s about handling the bank crisis. And the fact that since all money goes and funnels, as Carrie was just saying, and that's what made me think about this, since all that money, all that credit facilitation, those wheels all turn because the banks are there. Those banks aren't there. If those banks can't help those wheels turn, nothing happens, and you do start getting into a deflationary economy. I don't know what the state of Oregon is going to be doing about that. But that is a very interesting thing that distinguishes this from some of the other things that we've seen, and so I just thought I would just make a note about that.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given those statements and looking across the board of all your clients, sole proprietors, LLCs, corporations, partnerships, and being at the mercy of banks, doing fairly well, wanting to operate their businesses, having notes called, lines of credit, et cetera, is now a good time to, what would happen if we raised taxes on businesses?
I suppose in some ways it depends on how you raise them. If it's a net profit tax, might not get much. If it's going to be a minimum tax, it, you know, it's one more item that's probably going to kill the small business. If there's a $5,000 minimum tax for a large corporation, they can still manage to pay that. But I think the small businesses, it would really be extremely difficult, and it's just one more thing to that cash flow that finally convinces them to close the door.
I wanted to mention one other way that our clients are dealing with it, and that is in their 2009 estimated tax payments. I'm seeing a lot of our clients reducing and lessening how much they're going to be paying in their 2009. Most of our clients in prior years have always paid in Safe Harbor, which for federal was 110% of the prior year tax. For Oregon was 100%. One thing we didn't point out in the 2009 legislation is that the federal has changed that Safe Harbor from 110% to 90%, which doesn't impact Oregon because Oregon has its own rules. But our clients across the board are definitely paying in less, anticipating that they're going to make less. Mm-hmm. So the cash flow, it's one way for our clients that they're dealing with the cash flow, and it's obviously going to be seen at the state level in terms of revenue that they receive.
From your perspective, as we move toward April 15th, what do you think we're going to see on April 15th? Do you think we're going to have a big shocker in less taxes paid, more taxes owed, more refunds owed? What do you see? How would you predict that based on your perspective?
I'll take that one if you'd like.
Go ahead.
I don't think the impact is really going to be there on April 15th as bad as it's going to ultimately wind up to be. I think that much of 2008 wasn't really a bad year, but the fourth quarter, I mean, got to be pretty bad for certain industries, retail, and then the month of December specifically, because in this area we had those snowstorms. Commerce just stopped. I had one client that was closed for almost two weeks. Their month of December was a disaster. That's not as bad as what we're going to see starting in calendar 2009. I think that's when we're really... So in my business, what I see is I'm always looking back, mm-hmm. and things always look mm-hmm. different because I'm always a year behind everybody else. Everybody else is living in the present, and here I am thinking, God, this guy's doing great. Man, what a wonderful year he's had. And it's like, and he's screaming bloody murder because he's looking today at where his revenues are and where his payroll is today. So I don't think we're going to see a huge shocker on April 15th. There could be some industries, there could be some specific businesses that are going to be just an eye-opener. But I think that by and large, it's going to be a tail-off, and then things are really going to hit. Because 2009 is going to be a year where I think we're going to be in bad shape the whole year as an economy, just the entire U.S. economy. That's my guess.
Yeah,
I'm not an economist.
I'm glad you pointed
out. You have
that
a
out.
Real economist here, so I would always defer to the real economist.
We always defer to our real economist.
Right.
I would say, though, that a lot of those people aren't going to be able to pay those taxes. That the bottom line may say tax due,
right.
and that it's not a lot different. But I don't know. I think we're starting to see so many businesses have a real struggle that, do they do the payroll? Do they do the tax? And it's going to start to be a dance. And I'm seeing that. So I think it may be due, but will it be paid? We don't know. So I think that may be where we're going to see a reduction in the revenue.
And that is a good point. We tend to live in the present around here, and we have to remind ourselves that, you know, for much of 2008, and that's what will come due on April 15th, and April 15th won't have any reflection of 2009, although we will see it, I imagine, in reduced quarterly payments
right.
as we go through the years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you. I heard on the radio yesterday that the federal government is looking to discontinue the senior medical deductions, and that discussion is ongoing within this building as well. Do you have any particular reflections on that, if it is in fact discontinued, and what impact it might have on people and on our economy.
I haven't heard of that.
Tell me again, the senior, not Social Security.
No.
Itemized
medical deductions.
Oh, itemized. Oh, okay.
The Oregon deduction?
Well, what I heard was that the federal government was going to discontinue those benefits of itemized
deductions
those medical,
for medical
expenses.
Well, and probably from our standpoint, we don't see a lot of deduction there because it's got to be, you know, in excess of what, 7% of adjusted gross income. So you have to have a substantial expenditure. So, you know, even, and it probably is the seniors that do finally get up there to a point or a very large unexpected medical bill, but it is the seniors that finally do get there where their income is lower and they exceed that 7%. So,
This is one of those opposites where Oregon allows specifically a deduction for those deductions. And so even though federal, they may be phased out on the federal return, Oregon specifically allows a deduction for the elderly medical deductions.
But anything above zero.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So even though they may have gotten no benefit on the federal return, they're receiving a benefit for all of those on their Oregon return. But I hadn't heard about that proposal, so I'm sorry, I'm not familiar.
And actually, Senator Morris, it isn't a senior deduction at the federal level. It applies to anyone over 7.5% of adjusted.
It does. But what we see from a tax standpoint, it probably is
more for seniors
because their income's lower and their expenses are greater, so they finally exceed that 7%. Because for your ordinary person, hopefully, you're not to that extent.
Right. Other questions?
Madam Chair, it's really hard for me to resist, and I have to repeat this joke once every session, so this is my opportunity to do it. Since you were talking about having a real economist in the room, that I have heard that economists are those people that are good with numbers but don't have the personality to become accountants or CPAs.
I've heard the same said about actuaries. I've never met an actuary.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee?
Well, I know I'm sure you're going to do it, but I would express our very deep appreciation for the work that you do. And it's obviously without pay. I know Carrie Schoenfeld has participated on our Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring Advisory Council. And so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I, on behalf of the whole committee, I really want to thank you and thank Rob Douglas and Joan Buck for organizing this or getting it set up. And we couldn't do it without you. So it's
thank
a wonderful
you.
Tradition, and I hope to see it continue.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Yeah.
And let Rob or Joan know if we can answer any other questions as we move along.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.